on today's program, a long chat with writer Wayne McCauley. His latest book from Text Publishing is called Demons. He's previously the author of three acclaimed novels, Blueprints for a Barbed Wire Canoe, Caravan Story, and The Cook. In this one, he rounds up a group of characters who decide to go away for a weekend, leave the phones behind, turn off the computers, stop time, and tell each other stories. They're seven old friends, and they decide to get back to basics.
The telling stories idea came to me a long time ago, thinking along the lines of Boccaccio's Decameron or Scheherazade, 1001 Night, Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, and maybe whether I could sort of create a modern conceit of that. You know, the first thing to juggle, who's going to tell what story and what is the content of the story, how that's going to relate to the character. As with all those kinds of literary works, there's the framing, what's called the framing story. And then the framing story has its own kind of complexities too, you know, happening over a sort of 48-hour period, and all the things that go on there and then reflect back into time's past, maybe even time's future. It's a beautiful old literary device. I mean, people have been using it way back since then.
That's right. So you have to decide on who your pilgrims are.
Yeah, that's the first thing, I suppose. Or in the case of Decameron, who might be fleeing plague-ravaged Florence, which is probably more on the money actually for this particular book. The characters that people the book. Do seem to be trying to run away from something.
Well, that's what, at the beginning of the book, that they're all saying, basically, they're running away from the modern world in the sense that everything's too fast, we never listen to each other anymore, we never tell stories, we just give sound bites, and so we're going to do something about this and step out of the rat race and tell each other stories for a weekend.
Pretty much, that's it, yeah. I mean, that's the basic plot. And I suppose it does owe something to the Decameron in that sense, and if that historical plague could be considered in any way a metaphor, I suppose they're trying to escape the plague of modern civilization.
Yeah.
Like everything these days, you know, we sort of carry that with us. It's very hard to escape, let's be honest. You know, the planet has been explored and explored again. Just the idea of escaping from modern life is a complex and problematic thing these days.
That's right. And, of course, they don't escape in the sense that they all bring their mindsets with them.
Well, I think that's the essence. Yeah, that's right.
That's the whole point. So one of them immediately starts rebuilding the place that they've gone to in his mind because that's his day job.
That's Evan, who's the new partner, so slightly younger, actually, of the group, younger person of the group, of the woman Megan who has devised this weekend away. Evan's a bit of a rogue character. I kind of like him for that reason.
Yeah.
But his obsession is with real estate. You know, he's kind of gone into doing up old houses and selling them and speculating on the property market. And throughout the book, of course, you know, that becomes an almost comical obsession of his.
It does. I think on the first morning after they've had their evening storytelling and they've slept a night, then the first morning's discussion is all about house prices in the paper.
I must admit, I very much enjoyed writing that.
Not everyone will have gone away for the weekend with friends, but we all go and stay with friends, don't we? And especially if it's people you're catching up with after some time or they're in another state or another country and you think maybe this is going to be really significant this time.
Yeah.
And actually, you just talk about house prices in the paper.
That's right. And you talk nonsense, which I'll happily admit to the reader that the people in this house do just talk, if you'll excuse me, crap. A lot of the time, you know, they are really just talking about the most mundane things a lot of the time. Mind you, as the weekend progresses, and I suppose the book digs deeper into these, who these people are and what society they seemingly are fleeing from, then the talk gets a little more profound.
Well, and this is where you had to make all sorts of style choices because the people talk to each other in a very conversational way, as you would imagine, in a realistically conversational way. But once they get started on their stories, they speak in a rather more literary kind of manner. They speak like story writers.
Yeah, it was a real challenge of this book. And as I say, I had the idea in my head for a long time. And actually, probably the reason I hadn't written it a long time ago is because I couldn't figure out whether that idea, how to make that idea work. You know, that is the segue, the transitional moment where where an ordinary so-called realistic character in a so-called ordinary and realistic setting becomes actually a storyteller, you know, in a really ancient and traditional sense. In a literary way. So they adopt all the affectations, I suppose, of the literary storyteller.
Mm.
And of course, so the voice will inevitably gradually change. But I guess, you know, I suppose in some ways, well, that might seem like a long stretch, you know, that, well, how could an average, you know, middle-aged Aussie person suddenly become, adopt a literary voice, storytelling voice? But I kind of don't see any reason why not.
Mm.
And in fact, you know, there's plenty of occasions where I've heard someone, particularly, you know, when they're in their cups, you know, tell a long and involved story that has all the twists and turns of a great, great piece of literature, you know, that is completely involved in the moment and utterly, you know, engaged with the sound of their own voice,
yes,
the sound of their own storytelling voice.
Yeah.
So I guess that was the risk of the book, I suppose, but also the great ambition of the book was to be able to devise a way to make this conceit. And I admit, you know, that, like, much of literature is made up of certain kinds of conceit,
mm,
and this is a very ancient conceit that people can suddenly, you know, in the same way that a musical people suddenly burst into song, you know, and that is a conceit, but an accepted one. I've always been, I suppose, a writer to mix it up in that way. Yeah. To some extent, maybe this book is, you know, perhaps, you know, a more realistic work of compared to my others. But then, of course, in that way, in another way, it's completely not, because it's such an artifice, really, and an artifice, you know, as I say, like, you know, whether it be opera or music or that ancient art of storytelling, you know, I mean, it is a construction.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed that. I enjoy mixing it up, and I certainly don't mind laying down a challenge occasionally to the reader.
Depending on people's states of mind, you intimate that some of them are telling stories that they've worked up over time. I think the first story, is it Lauren's story?
People say,
yes, we've heard this before. So you think to yourself, well, that's okay, she's perfected it. It's a bit of a party piece.
That's right, and it's important. That's the first story, so I suppose that's the moment where I need to be really wary of the reader's you know, antenna up, saying,
yes,
oh, do I believe this? Do I not believe this?
Yeah.
So, you know, we work hard in that first part to allow the conceit to seem natural, and I suppose that's part of it. In other words, it has a kind of an almost offhand quality, saying, well, look, you know, I heard this story from so-and-so, you know, it really is authentic, it's true, isn't it? She speaks aside to her husband, and he confirms that, yes, I've heard this story before. It is, again, artifice, but it's all a part of the game that the writer plays between reader to convince them to go into the story. You know, don't be afraid. It's not going to hurt you.
Each of the storytellers has quite different voices, and depending on how urgent it is for them to tell the story and whether they've thought much about it before,
you
ring the changes. So
that's
Evan's
right,
story is more of an urgent, fairly cobbled together one.
Probably the most spontaneous, I suppose,
yes,
across the couple of days that they spend together. His story happens on the Friday night that they've arrived, quite late, and also it's actually quite unique in the fact that it's the only story that's not shared with all members of the group.
Yes.
It's shared with, you know, his mate, although we couldn't really call him his mate, but a friend through the sort of the circles, Adam. So he shares that story only with one person, which gives it a kind of interesting and almost truthful, perhaps disturbingly truthful kind of flavour to it, about Evan examining his relationship with his troubled daughter, actually,
yeah,
is what the story is essentially about. But then it morphs into a story about the guy who happens to be Evan's age, that his troubled daughter starts going out with.
Yes.
So obviously this is very troubling,
yeah,
all round.
Yeah,
Evan.
It's a great story too. It's a really good story. It's got all of the kind of loose ends that life stories do tend to have. And by this stage in the book, we're starting to expect that you, as the narrator, you know, with your omnipotence, will be doing what you've done a few times since already, which is give the what happens in real time somehow some kind of parallel with the story that the most recent person has just told.
Yeah, that happens a few times, I suppose, where I suppose they're not reluctant to talk about the theme or the content of the story that's just passed. And some of those become group conversations, but then some of them become little private conversations too. Like there's one There's a lovely, I think a lovely, conversation just after Evans finished his story, you know, and he heads off to bed saying, oh, God, I'm going to get in trouble for staying up late drinking. He goes off to bed, and Adam, the final stayer, goes to bed and has a little bit of pillow talk with his wife Lauren, and which is clearly the Evan's story. Not only Lauren's story, which as we said was the first one, but Evan's story likewise has set something a little bit disturbing in his mind, and he feels compelled to speak of it with his wife, and so that becomes a trope, a kind of a thing that happens quite often, which is that the idea that the story sets up in the characters' minds tends to have a resonance that continues.
Something else you decide to do that's a stylistic choice is you don't use quotation marks. People's conversations all go on unpunctuated almost, and with your commentary and their commentary, and that's all fine. We get used to that. But as people prepare to tell stories, you stop the flow and you give us a title. So, Leon the Broken String, I've opened to here.
I mean, I hope I'm not being too playful with the reader, but a part of this thing we're talking about is this kind of sense of play that's going on, you know, between the book and the reader, and how much is it true, you know, how much is this an artifice and how much is it real? Because at sometimes I would hope the reader would believe it all to be utterly real and be completely absorbed and engaged in it as a realistic novel. But of course, it's not a realistic novel. It's something I can't quite describe. But the titles of the stories are a part of that. So there's always just a little space break, and the name of the person who's about to start telling the tale, and then the name of the tale. And I really I thought really carefully and juggled this a lot in the editing about what was the start of the tale, because sometimes they have a little prelude conversation. They begin the story, so to speak, and there might be a little bit of back chat from the others, but the story starts. But it was really interesting finding exactly the moment where that person is about to enter, so to speak, storytelling mode. And that's the markers of that, I guess.
That's right. And Leon's story, just to add another layer, is about his early days as a student activist, but also about producing a Chekhov play. And he finishes his story with a quote from, I think, from The Cherry Orchard.
Yes, he does, indeed. Yeah, I was really interested very early on, very, very early on, someone, when I was talking about the idea for this book, someone said to me, oh, so you mean like it's an ensemble piece? That was a little light that went off in my head. And, I mean, I'd already had some of these ideas that are in, actually, Leon's story, and I had been thinking about the sort of the late Chekhov plays as a kind of a template, you know, for what I wanted to do. This person said to me, it's an ensemble piece. I thought, yes, that's so absolutely right. I'm going to confine these people to a house, a la Chekhov, you know, a country estate. And I'm going to sort of forensically examine what happens between them. I'm going to overhear their conversation, and occasionally, which would be different from Chekhov, and occasionally comment on it. So Chekhov became a bit of a template, actually, and I couldn't then help, of course, you know, referring the reader back to that. I hope not with bells and whistles on.
No.
But I hope in a subtle way to suggest. Also, I suppose what the book is speaking about, you know, subtextual sense that, you know, Chekhov's late plays really are full of these people yearning for something else, that they this sense of dissatisfaction, but also really strongly this sense that change is coming, that we can't stay in this sort of static, atrophied moment any longer, that something must change, that some great winds are coming to blow all this away, I think is a quote even directly from one of those late plays.
Yes.
So I was really interested in that also, not just in a sort of structural or stylistic sense, echoing some of the great things Chekhov did, but also having a look at what time Chekhov was living in and what his characters were actually saying, and also thinking about how relevant that is to now.
Well, actually, that's quite a poignant moment in the story, because he's doing Virchanen, as you say, and he says, I've talked a great deal, forgive me for that, to He did the crooked smile. So I'll go off by myself, he said, and then he was gone. Stories are all we've got. You can only get across what's happened to you by making an attempt to tell your story.
What good stories are to us ripples throughout the book, and I don't know that the book necessarily comes up with a resounding yes to that question, Kath. I'm not sure that it says, stories will save us. But that's what we do. That's right. It's how we connect, you know, both in a face-to-face human sense and also through the media of literature. It's a tricky thing in these times, the question of, you know, sort of truth and fiction. There's been a lot of this going on lately. I mean, I suppose, you know, what's become called faction, you know, where people are mixing it up in terms of the reliability of narrators.
And, yep.
You know, memoirs that seem to not really be memoirs, that seem to be fictionalised memoirs, these kinds of things. But I think it's everyone just really wondering about what's happened to this truth with a capital T, and whether it's possible to even cite it, you know. If we had to take our politicians as an example, then it's very hard to hold on to this concept of truth when, you know, when we see on a press conference or on the television, when we see how a lie can be told so seemingly truthfully. When, you know, in other words, you know, and my book sort of refers to that idea of theatre through Chekhov and so on, you know, when the actor can so utterly inhabit his role and so, you know, utterly live the lie that we believe the lie, you know, to be the truth. So flip that around, paradoxically, and ask the question from the other side, well, if truth is such a wobbly concept now, maybe fiction's where it's at.
Aha, uh-huh. And I've
you
just...
know, maybe fiction, maybe storytelling, maybe that ancient thing that just will never go away, is something that might reveal deeper truths to us in ways that contemporary facts, data, all those things...
I've just opened to the crucial page, I think, page 148, where... let's see, Adam says, I think we're living through interesting times so far as truth is concerned, and one of the main reasons is that we've confused it with facts. Facts, to my mind, are as little to be trusted nowadays as lies because there are so many of them. Call it data, if you like. Just because these are all the facts doesn't mean we should listen to them. In fact, when so-called truth comes at us in an avalanche like that, 1,000 tiny bits, shouldn't we be more inclined to distrust it? And then, so he makes a bit of a speech there, and Leon starts clapping with a wry smile on his face. Art is going to save us, said Lauren flatly.
Flatly, yes. I'm not sure that all in the room are believing it. you know, and also, you know, remembering that some of the professions here, these are middle class professionals that I've.
I think it's important the professions you've given them. Do you want to list what they are?
Megan, who sets up the whole idea, so a bunch of these guys, not all of them, but a bunch of them were friends at university. So Megan is the instigator of the Weekend Away. She's a documentary maker. Evan, I suggested, actually Evan was used to be a musician and still, you know, drags the guitar out occasionally. Mm. But, you know, he's moved into property development on a low grade scale. So Adam and Lauren. Adam is a lawyer, but he's not a criminal lawyer. He's a lawyer dealing in intellectual property, which I kind of like that idea that he's kind of, you know, somehow in defence of ideas. And Lauren works in advocacy, and it's never spoken as to what actually, you know, it seems to be she's a freelance advocate, and we're never quite sure what or why, which does play into her character in really kind of interesting ways, I think. Mm. So Leon is Megan's brother, and Leon was a journalist, since retired, during the course of the book he reveals some of the reasons for that, and he's clearly a very jaded man so far as, well, journalistic truth is concerned. Mm. In that sense he sort of plays almost like a Greek chorus to Adam's, you know, enthusiasms for art and so on that we just talked about then. And he's hooked up with a younger woman called Hannah, who's a bit of a mystery, I guess, throughout the book. But there's something really beautiful and wistful, dare I say, hippie, like about Hannah that kind of cuts through the crap quite often. You know, there's something really actually when it all comes to it, I suppose, who is the person simply living the truth in that house is probably Hannah. fly in the ointment that we haven't spoken of. Last but not least, Marshall, who's a late arrival, is a recently elected politician.
Yes.
So again, he's grappling in a big way, actually, with truth and lies, integrity, and so on. And it was to be four couples, eight people. He was to bring his wife Jackie with him. But prior to the beginning of the book, a momentous incident has happened back in the city, and Marshall has ended up racing down to the coast quite late, and he's brought his teenage daughter Tilly with him instead of his wife Jackie.
Mm.
And so Tilly plays gradually as a sort of a presence, almost an eerie presence, I suppose. Kind of an off-stage presence, if you like, if we look at the theatre analogy, throughout the book. But he's clearly a player, and I guess the most important part of her being flying the ointment is that she has brought her mobile phone with her.
That's right.
She is the one that's connected.
You have to cook up a climax for the real life situation, as well as the mini climaxes and denouements of all of the internal stories.
Well, I suppose that's what a frame story is. So I was always really keen to treat the frame story as in the same narrative sense as the stories themselves. Each of them build to some sense of climax or some sense of resolution, denouement. So I was constantly looking at the frame story. So I had the ending, I have to say, of the frame story in my head from the very beginning.
Mm.
So I was always working towards what ends up being essentially, I suppose you could say, it has a denouement very late on the Saturday night.
You keep up the suspense by putting them in the middle of a storm. That's always a good trick.
This is winter, and it's on the Great Ocean Road here in Victoria, which is pretty wild. Well, to be very, very wild in winter, and so that plays havoc, of course, as the night goes on as well. So the denouement, I suppose, happens on the Saturday night amongst the participants. And I guess the Sunday morning, which is a very, very short chapter at the end, we might look at as maybe the coda, which kind of gives us some sense of what has been happening and why some of these characters were so rattled, and does build to a certain, which I would assume that a reader would think, once we've got there, of course.
You had to decide what kinds of stories each of them would tell. I mean, they come out of the sorts of people that each of them are. But I think at the beginning they say, well, let's not make them all about adultery or...
Let's not make them all about family and sex. Ironically, of course, the first story is precisely about infidelity.
Yes.
And so on. So I was having some fun with that. But of course, you know, and they're not after that, let's be honest. They're not about those things. And I guess that was an interesting, I suppose, a way, again, a wink to the reader, but an interesting way of saying, look, you know, this might be getting set up here as a traditional novel, and in that sense, I suppose, the expectation might be that every one of the stories would be about, infidelity or family or, you know, affairs and your children's troubles or what. And so I was deliberately making an attempt and making a nod to the reader there, that to say that, you know, the setup here is realistic, and you can feel safe with that, but, you know, don't expect the usual material. And so the stories become, I suppose they do connect to the characters, but progressively, I suppose, they also become more and more strange in a way, perhaps. Surreal's not the right word, but they certainly seem to just go off the edge occasionally.
Off-centre.
Into some strange and dark territory.
Yeah.
And I guess that happens increasingly and ends with the last story told late on Saturday night by Adam, which certainly is disturbing by the end, and maybe is the kind of catalyst to set a whole lot of things in motion after that happened.
Yeah.
It certainly in some ways rattles the room, so to speak.
It's so clever, Wayne, and the way we've been talking about it makes it sound as though it's a very artificial sort of outing, but actually it reads tremendously well.
Oh, well, that's great to hear, because I'm a writer who is always attentive to the rhythms and to where my reader You know, where do I want to take my reader? And I don't, you know, I want to challenge my reader with sometimes confronting ideas, but I never want to lose their interest. That would be fatal. So, you know, I set myself a really clear task with this book, to keep the language very simple, to make it uncluttered, you know, to make it really pure. I go back to Chekhov, I suppose, a writer who was able to deal with really profound topics, but do so in such simple language, you know.
Yeah.
So I really wanted to go for that. That was my ambition, was to make this book incredibly readable, and as I suppose, actually quite simple, really, on the surface.
Yeah.
But to allow its complexity to develop underneath.
Yeah, I think that worked beautifully. And finally, we've talked about those early models and that whole business of being on the precipice of change and commentary on the mores of the day, and it's not actually, hasn't got an apocalyptic feel about it. You don't feel as though the Holocaust is just around the corner somehow.
No, but it's suggestive that you know, things are not right.
Mm.
I guess. I suppose that's the if I was to describe some overarching feeling of the book,
yeah.
More like the feeling of the characters, the collective feeling.
Well, it is called Demons, after all.
And it's called Demons, that's right. And it suggests that all is not right, both with these people and the world. Mm. And there's certainly a sense, you know, as the storm rolls in, as nature sort of declares herself, that maybe change, you know, is coming, or something's going to happen. I wouldn't call it by any means an apocalyptic book, but there's certainly a sense, as in Chekhov actually, where there's something over the horizon, and is it going to be a good thing or a bad thing? That kind of captures a little bit of a feeling in the zeitgeist at the moment. Mm. We're in a kind of a holding pattern, and we're all wondering, you know, is the world going to get better, or is it going to go to the dogs? And I guess these people are no different.